Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Clive Anderson. Welcome to My Seven Wonders. In ancient times, hanging gardens, great pyramids, and other superstructures were celebrated as wonders of the world. And like Days of the Week and Deadly Sins, there were always seven of them. But what are the seven wonders you would put on your personal list? That's the question I ask my guest in this podcast. And the guest I'm asking today is the stand-up comedian, writer, actress, and broadcaster, Olga Koch. So, thank you very much. Oh.
Hi.
So, Olga, I hope that's reasonable to describe you as a Russian comedian. I think you're officially British now, aren't you?
I'm both, and I sound like neither.
Yeah. So did you have to go through all that procedure of proving that you knew who starred in Only Fools and Horses to prove that you were really
British?
Oh,
yeah, you're on the test. Did you know that?
Am I?
No. Sorry. But I think you should be. I think you should be every year.
Well, I doubt it. But so you've done all that procedure. But so you started life in, is it St. Petersburg? You started.
Yeah.
And what sort of age were you when you left St. Petersburg?
So I lived in St. Petersburg until I was two, but I lived in Russia until I was 14. Then I moved here, but I went to an American school, and that's why I sound the way that
all
I did.
All right. So an American school in England.
Yeah, in Staines, of all places.
Staines. Always sounds such an attractive place, doesn't it? Staines. Maidenhead, Staines. All those lovely names around there. But I didn't mean to link those quite. Sorry. I'm just thinking of weird names. I think you went to university in America as well.
Yes, and then I came back here.
All right, okay. And just to establish what you're doing here now, you've been to the Edinburgh Festival before. What's your show this year called?
This year, my show is called Prawn Cocktail. Is on at Monkey Barrel, and it's on at 7:35 every day.
All right. Well, we should be finished minutes before that, so we can get you back there. So I can tell from your wonders that stand-up comedy plays an important part in your life, and indeed Edinburgh. We'll come to that. So you do comedy, but you went at university. You were studying, is it computer science,
yes,
mathematics, those sort of things?
I studied computer science for undergrad, and I got a master's in social science of the internet. And I worked for tech companies for like 6 or 7 years.
Right.
So that's just a hobby. This is my job.
Well, that sounds like a important career that you could have been following there. It's an expanding area that people who know about that sort of stuff are in big demand.
But there's not nearly enough as much money as there is in radio comedy.
I appreciate the irony of that. Well, now you're on a podcast as well. Barry Cryer, if you know who I mean by that, he's an old-time comedian and a scriptwriter. He had a great line about, he said, podcasts. He said, "God, podcasts? They're marvellous. I didn't think it was possible to pay less than radio." So you came to England with your family, to Surrey, with your family. Now, it looks like, from what I've got noted about it, your father sounded like a rather important person
in
Russia.
I think you, and I don't want to assume, you may be lifting facts from my Wikipedia page,
inaccurate. Oh, do you know? Tell me about it. My Wikipedia page.
What are the lies on yours?
Well, it's unfortunately they've changed.
We can go all edit it right now.
No, I'm a big fan of Wikipedia, but they had my height wrong, which almost got me in an Italian a film or TV series set in Italy. Because they had my height down at something like 5 foot, and the part I was auditioning for, and I'm not very tall, but I'm a bit taller than that, so it required me to be doing the scene and then like a Danny DeVito way, then stand up and be sort of shorter standing up than I was sitting down. So
it is a great gag.
Yes.
When that happens.
Yeah. Anyway, that's my wig. So I've got the misinformation from your Wikipedia.
Yes, fake news.
So why did your father and mother and you come to to Britain. And
so I came here, but they went to Germany. But essentially, our entire family was escaping Russia because my dad's wanted.
All right.
And if any of that sounds interesting to you, you can check out Fight on Radio 4, which is my special that details all of that.
All right. So that sounds, I know this is a sort of lighthearted conversation, but that sounds quite quite serious to be the news stories that we see about Russians who are not popular with other Russians. Sometimes it ends with them, you know, falling to their death from a basement window, that sort of thing. It's so this may be more of a worry to you than I'm
The amount of times I'm asked just generally, very casually, can this get you into trouble? And my only answer is, we're going to have to wait and see.
All right. So, I won't press you on your views of...
I'm on Ukraine's side. Just to be... that's a very low bar for applause, but just to be perfectly clear.
Yeah, it's a crowd. No, I've seen you on television talking about President Putin and his funny ways, if that's the...
I apologize, this is an early afternoon show, but I have been on television saying, Vladimir Putin, you can suck my dick. So if anyone doesn't know what my views are, I hope that's clear.
It's clear in some ways, but... let us stray onto your wonders, your first wonder that I've written down as you sent them in. Monkey barrel bathrooms. Now, monkey barrel is where you're doing your show. So you're using bathrooms in the sort of American use of bathrooms. You mean lavatories, toilets, loos. So I'm fairly familiar with the backstage area of a variety of venues, grand and not so grand. What are you saying about the monkey barrel bathrooms then?
So first of all, there's a special place in my heart for Monkey Barrel, the venue, because I do think, maybe I am biased, but it's the greatest comedy venue in the city. It's a comedy club year-round, much like The Stand. So when other acts have to go into like a shipping container and have to spend 5 to 10 minutes sort of explaining to people that they're not being human trafficked and they are, in fact, in a comedy show.
Yes.
The acts at Monkey Barrel and The Stand have the sort of privilege of going onto stage in a comedy club and not having to explain themselves.
No, so it's a regularly, and presumably therefore, very well appointed backstage
it's
area.
Wonderful. Okay. It's wonderful. It's a wonderful, wonderful place. Everyone who works there is wonderful. But specifically for Edinburgh, what a way to start my seven wonders.
Yeah.
Every bathroom, it's like it's its own unit with a sink and a mirror, which is nice. Yeah. And then they have Wi-Fi, which is, in a city with this little reception, a treat.
Yes. So Wi-Fi in the weeing area is... that's a plus point.
You get your own sink as well. Yeah. I mean, I think I it's the little things. I've been here for a very long time.
Yes. Well, I can see how you might appreciate it. When comedy, stand-up comedy was kind of reinvented for young people in this country, by the UK, it started the thing called the Comedy Store in London. And I can tell you the facilities there backstage were not great. In their second incarnation, there was a dressing room for everybody, male and female, and there was a sink in the corner. That was about it, unless you wanted to mingle with the audience, which sometimes you didn't want to do.
I'd say one of the most, what they don't tell you when you start out comedy is the amount of green rooms that have a toilet behind a very paper thin wall where everybody else is sitting. So you'll be on a bill doing 5 minutes with like your comedy hero. Yeah. And then you're either not going to the bathroom or having Stuart Lee hear you pee.
Yes.
That's...
Yeah. Okay.
Now you're all making that decision in your heads. Would you do it?
Well, it's not necessarily that much better if you're in a...
Or listening to Stuart Lee.
No, well, I there's an old story about Marilyn Monroe when she... Who's that intellectual that she married in one of her... Arthur Miller. So I think it's a made-up story. But anyway, she was visiting the Miller family, his parents and things, and she had to go and have a pee. But she was embarrassed.
Thank you for putting into an accent I would understand. I could see that you changing we to be in your head.
So she, I don't know which is the correct, well, it's not too silly anyway. Anyway, so she was embarrassed about something. So she ran the tap while she was doing it. And then after when she left, he said to his parents, you know, what do you think of her? And the old father said, yeah, she was all right. But it's actually better in Yiddish, but I'm not going to get it right. But yeah, she's all right. But she pisses like a horse. But I think that's an old story they just attached to Marilyn Monroe. But anyway, so if you grand theatres in the West End of London and Broadway, for all I know, they have pretty ropey facilities backstage. So Monkey Barrel, this is not an ironic selection. It just happens to have very good bathrooms.
Yeah, fantastic. I mean, also just a fantastic venue with fantastic acts and staff. But also, while you're there, check out the bathrooms.
Okay. When did you start doing comedy? Was this something you were doing before you took up computer science, or as a reaction to computer work, or how did it work?
I think coming from an Eastern European country and Eastern European mentality, I don't think anything artistic was ever on the cards for me when it came to university. So
Wait a minute, there's a lot of artistic people come from Eastern European. Russia is a home of novels, of ballet, of opera.
But that comes from, that doesn't come from university, that comes from suffering.
Okay.
we don't go to university for art.
No.
So it was always going to be a very limited selection of like chemistry, math, physics.
Yes.
And I'd say of all of them, computer science is just the easiest.
Well, not to everybody, because a lot of us have to use computers in our everyday life, but we're not confident of coping with them when they go wrong. So this is, being expert in computers is like gold dust, isn't it?
I wouldn't know.
I'm sounding like a parent trying to encourage you to go back to do
your
sensible work.
Yeah, I'll go back.
Work.
I'm sorry, Dad.
but did you do it at which university were you at in America? Was it one?
New York University, NYU.
There's another yelp of approval.
Oh, did you
go to
NYU?
Yes.
Okay, cool.
Rather quiet for an American, if I may say so, but not to trade in stereotypes, but normally if you do a show with them, and wherever you mention them, they go, "Hey!" Whereas you ask somebody British where they come from, especially in London, they'll say, well, it's sort of like Barnes, but it's just not quite, it's in a different era. So were you doing it as a student? Would you do comedy turns there, or is this?
Yeah, I was doing sketch comedy at the university. I was taking classes and working at Upright Citizens Brigade Theater. So it was like my entire life was comedy, and then I was also doing computer science.
Yes,
for the job.
Yes,
Dad.
And do you employ any of your computer skills in putting your shows together?
Definitely. So my second show was about computer science. My current show is about my master's degree, which is more of a social science degree.
Yes.
To do with the internet.
Yeah.
And I also have a Radio 4 show called OK Computer. And every episode we take a computer science concept and we put it in layman's terms.
Yes.
So yes, I very much use computer science and all
okay,
of
so
my
stand-up. It's all brought together. Excellent. So Monkey Barrel Bathrooms. Now, this is going to sound... I'm just going to read out what you said.
I thought you said the pyramids.
people are going to now think we're going... staying in the same area. Well, we're not, because your next one is The Bucket Speech. But this is nothing to do with bathrooms. That's not
this
that sort of bucket, is
that.
It?
All of my wonders are Edinburgh Fringe themed.
Yes.
Because I thought it would be cute. And also because when you're at the Edinburgh Fringe, the world outside of it doesn't really exist.
I sort of understand that, but that you're taking an unusual route with the wonders of the world to just talk about things you're doing today and yesterday. Most people see it as an opportunity to bring in their interest from
big picture.
The sunset, you know, over the St. Petersburg
over the Monkey Barrel bathrooms.
Over the St. Petersburg skyline, or the site of England when you first landed in Surrey. Why is that funny?
It just stains at 7 p.m. Gorgeous. Yeah. No place I'd rather be.
Yeah. So I've got rather taken with the idea of Surrey. I was imagining sort of green and pleasant land, but I suppose if it's a bit more urban than that and stainsy, it's probably not as exciting.
Yeah, it's like a Pizza Hut next to a view. It's
yes.
Not...
Okay. Well, anyway, other
but it's
things.
It's my Pizza Hut next to my view.
But other things in your life, other right. than just what you're doing at the moment.
No. I'm sticking to the Edinburgh Fringe.
Yes. Okay.
The Bucket Speech.
Yeah.
So I'm sure people here have been to either free or pay what you want shows, but I feel like there's an institution of the Bucket Speech,
yes.
which is the speech that acts do at the end when they're trying to solicit money from the audience.
So is everybody familiar with this, the free fringe, where you don't have to pay in advance, you turn up and you have to then sit there agonizing of, oh no, I didn't bring any cash with me. How am I gonna get out?
Yeah.
Oh, they've got one of those readers. Oh, can you trust people? So you've done this to the free fringe, have you?
Absolutely,
yeah.
Yes. And so I think because like most of the material you write is obviously your own, but when it comes to the Bucket Speech, it's just sort of become almost like folkloric, where like what jokes you use for it.
Oh, right.
So it'd be like, it's free to get in, but not free to get out. Like
yes.
that sort of fun stuff. And there's like people will be exchanging them and making like twist on the old classics, and I just absolutely adore it.
Yeah.
And then, like, you'll get together and be like, okay, what's your bucket speech? Like, are you doing guilt? Are you doing fun?
Yes. So is that now behind you now? You don't do Free Fringe. You're now in a, you know, booked and paid for.
I collect money for charity at my gig. But again, I also have a gag for it because I collect all the money for Kyiv Pride, which is an LGBTQ charity in Ukraine, and then say, but the rest of the money is going towards a very promising cryptocurrency.
Yes.
Which gets a laugh sometimes. I just love how it's become a format in and of itself, the bucket speech.
And do you find audience...
Oh my God, one where you're like, okay, take your change and fold it. Come on.
Yes.
Come on. Oh God, I love a good bucket speech. Yeah.
So do the audience react well to that? It's kind of a relaxing bit of... Although they may be worried about how much money to give, it's a relaxing bit of comedy that they haven't got to concentrate. I understand. She's asking or he's asking for money. Depending.
But I hate to over-intellectualize it. I'm sorry. I hate to over-intellectualize it. But I essentially, what is comedy if not tension release? And where is there more tension than in if someone asking you for money and standing at the door and you have to leave without paying them and looking them in the eye? Oh. And so the fact that you can write a joke that releases that great attention, that's brilliant.
Oh, but I think
take 5 pounds and then put the wallet. Come on.
Yeah. So that does require the audience to have to think in advance. You can't come with no money, but it's no good, you know, having been just paid some debt with a 50-pound note and that's all you've got. I can't give 50 pounds for one.
Well, some bucket speeches are worth 50 pounds.
Yes. Well, you may think that, but not necessarily. So that's another side of the sort of showbiz aspect, not very showbizy aspect of doing comedy. If you're actually having to try and get people to pay on the spot, it's more like busking, isn't it?
It's. I mean, I suppose there's a lot to be said about that format, but I think it's also kind of wonderful that it's become a format in and of itself.
Yes.
Sort of like a horse walks into a bar format, or why did the chicken cross the road?
Yeah. Indeed. So the
chickens are what got me into show business. I saw a chicken crossing the road and I said, I got things to say.
Okay. All right. And is there a tradition, you left when you were quite young perhaps, but is there a tradition in Russia of stand-up comedy, or has it always been a bit dangerous to be, say, topically critical of the government?
There's loads of stand-up comedy, and there's been a recent boom, but there's always been a tradition of sort of almost like storytelling, maybe like short story writers. They'll come on stage and they'll read their short stories.
Yeah.
Then there's like a huge sketch comedy tradition where sketch comedy teams from different universities compete on TV, and people will do it so professionally that they will like age graduate university but stay in those teams.
Yes.
But I'd say like the most distinctive part of Russian comedy is anekdoty, which is anecdotes, but not really. They're like short. They're short stories that they're like, they're longer than a joke.
Yes.
But they're like, they belong to the people. So no, they're not authored.
Yeah.
And you just exchange them from a very young age.
And other than those, would people be able to make jokes about the current government, especially at the moment in
interpersonally, Moscow. Yes, but obviously not on any public forum.
So you're suggesting earlier on, you were saying, well, it's risky for you to make jokes. Is it genuinely risky for people when they're around the world making remarks about things back home in Russia?
I think it depends on where you are. I don't want to jinx it. I feel dizzy. No. I mean, no, obviously people who are on the ground in Russia don't feel comfortable doing this.
Yes.
And I just gigged in India, and in India, like it's really interesting to leave a country, the UK, where everyone's talking about how you can't say anything these days, and then gig in India where truly you can get arrested for criticizing the government in any capacity. And it really puts things into perspective.
Well, I was just thinking about your personal position, because I've seen clips of you on television program or two talking about the current president in Russia and his strange ways.
Are you scared?
No, I'm not.
You
I'm
can
not
say bad stuff.
I don't know. I don't want to push you into anything you don't want to talk about now, but you've done it on television. But are you just saying, oh, it is a bit weird, or are you genuinely fear there might be repercussions?
I don't really think about it that much. I mean, I don't feel safe going to Russia, if that helps.
Yeah.
My feeling or inkling is that I don't think they'd go through the trouble of poisoning me because I don't know anything. I just have opinions.
Yes.
The people they kill usually are like ex-KGB people who have intel. I don't got intel. I'm just mad.
Okay. So you can be as
opinionated
as you like.
I don't know. This is what I've told myself.
All right. Well, let's get back to your more comfortable area, which is back talking about the Edinburgh Festival Fringe. Flyers, people handing out flyers.
They're the heroes. They're the heroes of the Fringe.
Yes.
I truly believe that we as acts are a backdrop for a bunch of teenage flyers for falling in love with each other.
Yes.
I keep imagine being 19 and so excited and you're flyering for some show and then there's a cute boy flyering for the show at the same exact time, but it's a different show and you're rivals. And then it's like you see a person approaching, you're like, who's going to fly them first? And you hate each other, but then you fall in love.
Well, that could be your next year's show. You could do a play about that.
I'm too old to live it, but I can write.
You could write about your recollection. But is this all out of your imagination? Are you
I adore street teams. They're the backbone of this festival. They're amazing.
Well, I don't know if it happens at other festivals. It seems a unique Edinburgh institution. Yeah. And I'm never quite sure how effective it is because I've often asked, oh, what's the point of that? Surely not many people get a thing. Oh, yeah, I'll go to do that now. But I'm assured that people do. I don't know if the audience would agree that you do get a flyer and then you go, okay.
I love talking to flyers about their flyering techniques as well because they will like profile a person on the spot and be like, would you like the show or not?
Yes.
Or they'll decide which hook to use with them. I think it's brilliant. It's like the most analog on the ground marketing that we have.
Well, when I'm wandering around, I always think it's polite to take the flyer. If it's offered to me, I always take it. So that means once you take one, you end up taking 20 in a short space of time. So I'm now clutching, butter. But other times, I think my seniority, if I put it like that, they sometimes look at me quickly and think, no, it's no point giving somebody. This is he's not for our sort of show. so it oscillates between two. So sometimes I can walk through the ground and get none. And other times I can hardly, stagger home with all the flyers. But so do you have a team of people flyering for your show and are you a benign employer?
The production company that I'm with have flyers, but they're amazing. Yes. They're like they're just running on enthusiasm alone.
Yeah. So I'm saying I know it only from Edinburgh. You've been around the world to different festivals and performances, maybe Australia, India you've mentioned. Do you get flyers there?
No, there's like this everything about the Fringe is unique to the Fringe.
Yes. Yeah.
That's an overstatement, but a lot of things are.
Yeah. So how do you find traveling around the world? What's and performing in different places? Is it much the same audiences you get in any part of anyway the English speaking world, or is it a different? You have to rethink it every time you go to, I don't know, Melbourne or Montreal or wherever you've had to perform.
I mean, again, to avoid platitudes, but because of the internet, there is a sort of like flattening of audiences, and there are some references that feel like safe bets, and you think that like we're all having these same conversations or we are aware of these news items and stuff. Yeah. That being said, I think because there is so much out there and because of like culture compartmentalization, it's very difficult to come up with like one pop star that everyone in every room is going to know, right?
Yeah.
Or like one athlete. I think maybe the last person that everyone in every room in the world would know would be like David Beckham. Ever since then, like if I say Taylor Swift, one of the like biggest recording artists right now, I don't think my mom would know who that is. And so I think
Rishi Sunak is a big fan of Taylor Swift. he's just been to a concert of hers in America, I think. Did I dream that? I have strange dreams, and I'm.
He went to a cycling class. Didn't he go into a spin class?
Oh yeah,
he went to a spin.
He's done other things as well. He can. That's the only thing he's done for the last 10 years. But no, I think Taylor Swift would be, or Madonna was a bit.
I think Madonna would have been more ubiquitous than Taylor Swift is now. I think it is interesting when it comes to like very specific cultural references that it's difficult to come up with something that appeals to everyone.
Yes.
Unless it's like from 100 years ago. And so what one of the fun exercises is to sit down with the local and just go through every reference in your show and be like, do you know this? Will this work? Or what is the local equivalent?
Yes. brands of chocolate.
Exactly, exactly. So I had a whole like running gag about Blue Lays, which is a type of Lay's potato chip that's only sold in India. And it was cool. It's cool that you get to have a punchline that's like only local. It's awesome.
Can I ask you about the English language?
Please.
Have I got the fact? I'm worried now. I've got a fact from Wikipedia. It might be wrong. Did I get it right? You arrived in the UK when you were 13. Was that the age you
Yeah, came? I mean, 14. But.
13, 14. Okay. Well, 40 even more so. Did you already speak English pretty well? So you were on top of things. So you had but you still got to fit in with the people at school. You probably didn't speak exactly the same way.
God, no. I mean, I think again, when it comes to like flattening and cultural references, I watched a lot of American television in the original, and so that's sort of where I picked up my accent.
Yes,
I think people like Scandinavian people also do that. And that's why they have like all have American accents.
Yes. Well, there's a strong tradition of learning English from the word, you know, very young age in Scandinavia. I don't know what it's like. I mean, you're the second Russian person I've... Just wait for this. You're the second Russian I've ever interviewed. The first one was Mikhail Gorbachev.
Oh, so the... No way! Gorby! Yeah. Oh, wow!
So that's why I said wait for it. So now he didn't
what
speak
company?
He didn't speak English at all. So I had to interview him through a translator, and I won't go on about it now because I do a one man show. It's called Me, Macbeth, and I. But my interviewing him features strongly in that. It's a long story. He's very, very funny and a very charming man to interview. But obviously a very educated man. But I mean, I imagined he was just sort of saying he didn't speak English to give him a bit of protection for because it was like a comedy chat show. But my strong impression, he really didn't speak any English at all. Maybe because you're obviously a much younger generation, maybe English is more, or maybe you just happen to go to a very good school in St. Petersburg.
Yeah, I think after the fall of the Soviet Union, English was pretty ubiquitous and everybody was learning it at school.
All right. So he can take credit for that because he led to the fall of Soviet Union. I don't think that's what he meant to do, but anyway, it did happen anyway. And hats off to him. Charming interviewee. So, okay, so that's Flyerers. So this leads us naturally, I suppose, onto your next wonder, which is international acts. International acts.
International acts.
Yes.
I love watching international acts at the Fringe. My seven wonders are a love letter to the Fringe.
Okay.
Yes. I love seeing what's funny in other countries. Isn't that cool?
Talking of international acts, I would say the most challenging set of wonders that I've had to deal with, other than this one, was from, I won't name him, but he's a comedian and he's German and he's very popular over here. And I think as a joke against me, his wonders, he just sat literally in a hotel room and looked around the room.
No.
He did. So his wonders were mirrors, windows. And he went through everything you could see from a hotel room.
That's
and eventually,
like Franz Kafka's seven wonders. Well,
his last one was hinges on doors. Now, it was quite a funny interview, but I don't think he was really desperately trying to reveal things about things he liked or respected. And I just... I wonder if this is your approach as well. You don't really want to say what are the wonders are in your life. So you thought, well, this will be a technique just to do it about the Fringe and its various aspects.
I don't think so. I think I really like international acts. I think, I mean, I guess that just this year I did stand up properly abroad for the first time in my life. And it really opened my eyes. And I've just had this very, very white woman just turned 30 realization that like, oh, the world is such a big place. which is embarrassing that it took me so long to come to this realization, but it's so cool.
So what sort of international acts are you thinking about? The Lady Boys of Bangkok, American comedians?
So there's a couple acts from India here who are brought over by Soho Theatre. It's Uruj, Saban, and Biswa. They're amazing. And then you watch them and you're like, I've never seen anything like this before, but I love it and it's so cool. Yeah. Like there's acts from Australia, like Grace Jarvis, Lou Wall, Hannah Camilleri. I mean, they're all just incredible.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting to see that like we have comedy in common as this language, but they speak it in a completely different way. I'm not saying about their accent. I'm saying about their sensibilities and joke structures and rhythms. And it's funny, but it's so fresh.
It's quite a challenge, though, as we've already discussed. Getting the audience on your side with stuff that you're used to doing in a comfortable way, but now you've got to adapt. So I suppose it's better if you're an acrobat, so you, that is truly international. have you ever been to Montreal, you know, the Just for Laughs?
No,
Just
I haven't.
Well, that's worth exploring. It's a big, been on for years and years, but it started originally as a French language show, and it's obviously it's English as well, which is tends to be bigger because it's got, you know, a lot of American people. And my French isn't bad, but I wandered into the French side of things when I was there. And I found it very, very hard to get the jokes because you need a very subtle understanding of language before you can get the wordplay or the subtle references.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'd include you in this, but all the people who come from a different language background, that they can perform or even be in the audience and understand the various, you know, slang-ridden comedy that you can find yourself watching.
Well, I tried performing stand-up in Russian and I bombed so hard.
Yeah.
Like, unbelievably bad, to the point where I would never do it again.
So you're performing in Russian. Was it to a Russian audience?
Yeah.
Oh, right.
And they hadn't.
No.
It was horrendous. Yeah.
Well, I was... Yeah, that's an interesting idea, that, because someone like Eddie Izzard is determined to go around the world performing even in languages they don't speak. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how... I don't know how effective that is, but if you're speaking in your original language, you must be on top of the nuances. Why would it? You maybe just had an off night the time you.
I think that knowing a language and performing in it are just two completely different things. Because yeah. I spoke fluent English at first when I started doing it.
Yeah.
But I couldn't perform. I bombed in English, so I think it's just
maybe you just always bomb. I don't know. I don't mean that. Well, other languages you speak as well?
I speak German and I speak some French, but right. I wouldn't dare do stand up in any of them. Well, because it comes to like word order, word play. Some puns don't work. I think one of the, and this is maybe me getting too granular with it, so I apologize. I apologize if I'm not being funny enough and I'm being too scientific, but listen to this.
Yes.
The thing that really fascinates me in languages is that there is very often not a one-to-one translation.
Yes.
Like even good in Russian and good in English, like the width of what they can describe is different.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of those things that is absolutely maddening, because sometimes in comedy, the thing that makes it funny is because like, oh, this word sometimes applies in this specific scenario.
Yeah.
And when you translate that word, that's not a guarantee that it has that wide of a description as well in that foreign language. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. And you probably know more about it from the various languages point of view, but English famously has lots of different words for the same thing. So
yeah.
And they develop their own subtle meanings because we have inputs from, you know, Germanic roots and French roots and Latin roots and Scandinavian, all going way back, and then lots of things coming in from America and around the world. So that makes for wordplay and things that probably don't translate
exactly.
Into lots of other. I'm sure German comedy is much more precise, but it can't.
And it takes so much longer.
Yeah. Friend, this, you know, in the way of Edinburgh, things are now blurring into my mind, but somebody, and I'll try and remember who it was, selected a particular sketch. Which is an English language sketch about an old woman and her butler being. Has anyone seen this? But it's on television in Germany and Scandinavia every New Year's Eve. But it was it's Freddie Frinton, who was his famous act was being a drunk. He played being a drunk. He wasn't a drunk, but he played that. Now
that does sound funny.
But it's English. It's an English comedy sketch, English language comedy sketch, which you know. But it's never seen in England or in Britain because it looks old and stale and very longers in it. But it's perfect in Germany. They love it. They can't. So it can translate sometimes in the most bizarre ways from one language to another. It's almost like a silent comic.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.
Now here's another odd wonder, if I may say so. Your next wonder is rogue child in the audience.
Oh, it happens every time. Mm. So I'm not gonna lie. I'm a little bit of I can go blue on occasion.
Yes.
All my shows are always 16 plus, and inevitably there will be at least one show where some really progressive parents decide to overlook the label And there will be an escorting of a child with earmuffs maybe 45 seconds into the show.
So because your act can be, you deal quite graphically in matters of sex and sexuality.
I'm quite open, I would say.
Yes.
And I think it's very clear in the 16 plus age suggestion. But and then like we've all been in shows where there's like, oh, this kid is too young to watch this. And I just think that there is a delight in the sort of general panic of the audience who clock what's happening on stage and then clock the kid, and then you could just sort of see the panic spread.
So what is the sort of cutoff? Because sometimes it's like, say, a 14-year-old boy in the front row of the audience, and the comedian will start talking about something a bit saucy, let's say. And the kid is maybe a bit embarrassed, but he's also enjoying it because he knows all about it anyway.
Yeah.
But if you go a lower age than that, much lower than age than that, then is that when it becomes particularly rogue or difficult?
And then at some point when you see a 6-year-old, you're like, I'm a bad person for saying this stuff.
Yes.
And then you have to be like, oh, I got to stop the gig. I can't change my script. It's just, I just feel like it's one of those, like people delight in improv or people delight in audience interaction because like it's a unique experience that only that audience is ever going to have.
Yes.
And I think it's just fun to throw a 6-year-old in the, because the thing is, even if it's a completely safe show, a 6-year-old's not going to enjoy any show.
No.
Unless it's got bubbles.
I wonder, people, even if they're not professional comedians, can relate to this, because quite often people have to make speeches at a wedding. They're the best man speech, or the father, or the mother of the bride, or the bride. They all get to make a speech. And inevitably, there are children at the wedding. And you can tailor it to thinking, well, there'll be a 14-year-old. But if there's a 14-month-year-old and they start crying, I wondered if that's what you meant by a crying child.
Oh, crying child is always lovely. Oh, I love a crying child. Makes it feel like you're in an airplane.
Yeah, but they can cry just at the wrong point if you're leaving a pause for a punchline. Then they scream, they get a laugh or a reaction, you've lost your moment.
But, yeah, you're always, Clive, you feel competitive with a baby.
So would you require your management, as it were, to be a bit stricter about letting people in and turn people away at the door? Oh, that's a 10-year-old, it's clever enough to understand the words, but too young to really be introduced to the discussion.
I don't know what the policy is, because I feel like if a parent insists that they're okay with it, then I guess they have to make that decision.
Yes. But in the nature of things, they don't really know, do they? It's not like a film that you can sort of check out, but with a stand-up act, I don't know how flexible you are in what you do, but sometimes it might not be the same tonight as it was 2 weeks ago.
Whatever it is, it's never safe for a 6-year-old. I can guarantee that.
Yes. Okay. So, and have you had do you get this every night, or is this every now and then? This is your nightmare. I'm not quite sure whether this is a wonder. It sounds like this is not something you welcome.
Oh, but it's so much fun, because once the kid leaves, we all have a nice laugh.
Yeah.
Like a light laugh of relief.
Yeah. So do you call for security and have them
escort the child out? Yeah.
Take that child out, with or without his parents. All right, so rogue child in the audience. Now, your next wonder is Pure Gym at the Edinburgh Quarter Mile.
Yeah.
So
24 hours. It's a 24-hour party, baby.
Yes. So so Quarter Mile is that sort of development of...
very, very new and sleek.
Mm. So you're doing well, I assume, if you're staying there.
No, I'm just going to the Pure Gym.
Oh, okay, right.
I'm just taking that lifestyle and wearing it as a costume.
So being a stand-up comedian is not necessarily a healthy lifestyle, is it? You're often out late at night. Some people drink a lot. Some people forget to eat. Some people eat very late at night, but it's those things may or may not apply to you. But either way, you're correcting it or coping with it by being a regular attender at gyms. You always go to gym every day, or what?
I try to. I'm going to be honest with you. That on the list is very door hinge adjacent.
Yeah.
In that I went to do Pure Gym Quarter Mile this morning, and I thought, all right, let's chuck it on the list.
I think it's reasonable to tell the audience that you very kindly agreed to do this at somewhat short notice. Because of,
but so, I'm having the time of my life. Thank you so much.
This is no criticism. It's a thank you to you. So you did have to come up with your list rather quickly, and you stuck rigidly to what you're doing today, rather than going back in any other aspect of your life. But it's very kind of you to do it. So that explains what that means. But so what do you do in the gym? What are you a runner.
I do it all.
Rowing.
I do it all. I did a triathlon this year. I'm very into pushing my body where it doesn't want to be pushed. But I think a 24-hour gym for a stand-up comedian is delightful, because if you have a bad gig, you just go to the gym and you punch it out.
Oh yes, excellent. Yeah.
You imagine that 6-year-old child.
No, yeah.
No.
That's so you imagine punching a 6-year-old child. That's a motivation for you. That's an interesting aspect of your character where you have to think about. So, but triathlon, that's a really hard work thing. Is that the one when you cycle for miles and miles and miles?
And then you swim and then you run. Yeah. And then the demons are still in your head.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and is this something you've always done as a, you know, you're an athletic person?
Oh, God. I try to.
Yeah.
I do find it odd. I do realize I put the gym on that list, but it really makes me upset whenever comedians talk about fitness.
Yeah,
because I'm like, well, that's not what you're meant to be. You're meant to be pathetic and broken.
Yes.
I don't want to know how good you are at running.
Yeah. Well, that's the. Yeah.
Yeah. Whenever a comedian's healthy, doesn't that put you off?
Yeah. Indeed, I don't like them. They're too good looking either. I want them to be self-deprecating at the highest and complete.
Whenever a comedian
wreck
has a
six worst.
Pack, it's wrong.
Yes. So you should heckle.
I'm canceling my membership.
No. Okay. So your final, your seventh and final wonder is the Fringe Hour. So what do you mean by the Fringe Hour?
So my first ever Fringe that I came to was 2015 as a punter. I'd never been to the Fringe before. I didn't know what it was. And then I remember sitting, I won't even be able to tell you what show, but it was the first time I've ever seen a Fringe comedy hour for an hour. And it blew my mind because I'd never seen that art form before.
Right.
Like my only exposure to a comedy hour was like a classic American stand-up comedy hour where it's just like bits, jokes, doesn't really tie together. Maybe a callback at the end, but that being it. Mm. And then seeing this sort of, what is the Fringe Hour if not like a hybrid of like a one-woman show and a little bit of a one-person play, and it is stand-up but it's also storytelling, and a lot of time it's multimedia, and it's this like its own beast that doesn't really exist anywhere.
Yeah.
Like occasionally it'll be a TV special, but there's no such, like there's no broad understanding of what that thing is until you go and see it.
So it's like a showcase hour you're talking about, where
where
the bits and pieces of the Fringe are put together, best of the Fringe. So I'm not sure I'm really.
Oh, no. Yeah. I mean like a 1 hour show by any comedian on
any
the Fringe.
So, yeah. Okay. Sorry.
A lot of the time it will straddle a lot of genres.
Yes.
Like it won't necessarily just be jokes. It will be a lot of time people will be telling stories or even sharing trauma in a way that like will use projectors and audio and lighting cues and like, I don't know, plants in the audience and all this stuff. Like I'd never seen anything like it before. And it doesn't really exist outside of the Fringe in like a large scale way.
But people who do like an hour show here.
Yeah.
Might then tour that hour around the country or add to it and turn it into a whole evening, a 2-hour show in the theater.
Yeah.
So,
but I think it's very rarely that those are the kinds of shows that then like end up as TV specials, because the ones that do are usually more classic straight stand-up, right?
Sure. Yeah.
So this sort of like theatrical comedy, it's not something that I've ever seen before.
So I'm just working out what you mean. So now you've got people who do a special on Netflix or something, and they'll do a show in the theater for a while, and then eventually it's good enough and tight enough that it can be filmed, and away you go.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I don't. Maybe I'm not explaining myself. But I guess like Richard Gadd's show Monkey See Monkey Do, or Sam Campbell's show last year, or Rosemary Faye's show a couple years ago, like all these shows, they're not just a person talking to a microphone and saying a list of jokes. They're,
right.
They utilize various. Am I? Does that make sense? What I'm trying to do? Yeah,
certainly does. But there's a lot of people who do 1 hour shows, and some of them are just telling jokes.
Yes.
Some put other things in.
Yes.
You're saying the fringe are, but the ones that have more to them than just
somebody because I've never seen anything like it before.
Okay.
And I do think it thrives and at the fringe.
Yeah.
There's no real place where you could see that all the time anywhere else.
So when you were in America, you came here in 2015, but when you were in America at university, did you go and see comedy clubs and improv clubs?
Yeah.
Did you like also that sort of evening when you have like somebody doing 20 minutes and then a compere and then bring on somebody else? That sort of comedy.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, like, and I saw hour long shows in America, but they're very much more straight stand up, just joke, 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 joke.
Yeah.
And I loved that. But I think it opened my eyes as to what comedy could be so much more when I saw a fringe hour versus what just a straight stand up show.
Yes. Because my first exposure to sort of stand up comedy was when it was lots of people in a comedy store or wherever. And they did 10 minutes or quarter of an hour. And you can still see those sort of shows. And there's an energy to those and an excitement. Oh, he's good. Oh, she was even better. Oh, I didn't. That two at the end were a bit weird for me. But, oh, yeah, you liked it. And that, whereas,
like a sampling platter.
Yeah. And there was a sort of challenge for the performer as well, because the audience didn't necessarily know who they were. And they might heckle a bit or they may go for it. Whereas a one-hour show with a named person, everybody has come along to see that person, and they're on that person's side, which is great, but it's not quite so much of a challenge. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think they're just trying to accomplish different things, both for the audiences and for the performers.
Yeah.
So my wonder is that, like, gorgeous art form that is the Fringe Hour.
The gorgeousness of it. And of course, it's expanded. People have been to lots of shows, even before 2015. I go back
before then.
The Fringe it sort of changes. It doesn't change. It's certainly got bigger and bigger and bigger. And that side of the Fringe, when I first came here, there wasn't really a stand-up scene, hardly at all. It was sketches and university things, and there was a lot of comedy. But now it's almost overwhelmed with stand-up shows, and as you say, they can vary in their structure. So how does that relate? How does that apply to you then? You've done more than 1 hour of appearing here, but what's the next step for you? Would you say?
I mean, I love the hour as an art form, and I think once I saw the fact that you didn't have to just be jokes. My first show had like lots of visuals in it. My second show was like explaining computer science and comedy. Like,
yeah.
I think once you've realized that it doesn't just have to be jokes, it could be anything.
Yes.
So I want to write a musical.
Seriously, or is
genuinely, I do. That's my next.
Let's come on to the musical in a moment. But so in your shows, and if you're going to make them more than just jokes, do you like to use a lot of audio visual stuff and film clips and stuff you've made, sound effects, computer generated things?
Yeah, so in my previous show last year, it was called Just Friends. It was a story told over an hour, and the device I was using was like a phone that kept receiving text messages throughout the show, and it would have audience members read the text messages that the phone received.
Right.
So that was fun.
Yeah,
I had a lot of fun with that.
There's always fun. My worry, either doing something like that or even watching it, is that if there's any technology involved, it can go wrong. On any given night, the text messages can stop coming, or the projection of the film can break down. And then you're obviously thrown back on your own resources, or there's an embarrassed, gap while things
are sorted. 6-year-old who can't read.
Yes. Or can read. It's even worse. a musical, which will be an all-evening musical you're going to write?
I basically, it's a bizarre, bizarre idea, but my master's thesis was about people called reply guys, and that's an internet phenomenon of men who interact with female public figures on the internet in like a very over-familiar way.
Right, they're called reply guys.
They're called reply guys.
I didn't know they were called that, but...
so it's like they'll be just like random men who will sort of attach themselves to female public figures and constantly interact with their content as if they're friends.
Yeah.
And so I spent 2 years interviewing them and sort of getting to know them. And so my dream is to write a musical that's sort of like almost like Six, but it's all different types of reply guys.
So what are sort of things that they say? I mean, are they...
They're not like... People
not
always
creepy
assume,
or they are creepy?
They're creepy, but it's not... in a most like eerily harmless way. They'll be like, hope you're doing okay. Hope you're having a nice day. Thinking about you. Like, it's almost like they're checking out on a girlfriend as opposed to lusting over someone.
Okay.
But yeah, yeah, they're interesting people.
Yes. So... We've
anyone in? Any reply guys in?
So we've come to the end of your seven wonders as you came up with them, but I'm still intrigued to know why you didn't include on your list of wonders something like the internet or the world of computers, which you know loads about.
Oh, I know so much about it, and I despise it.
Well, I was going to say, I think technology does that mean is horrible. It's no longer wonderful to you? Because for those of us who are users of it but don't understand it, it remains something of a wonder that it's... I mean, genuinely, when I'm researching some, I have to remind myself sometimes. I was first on television, and I wanted to research a guest. Well, somebody would do it for me. There'd be a researcher, because they'd have to go to a press cuttings agency and find somewhere that happened to have pasted and cut things out of the papers. And it was a laborious task. Now at 3 a.m, if I think, I wonder if they were in, I can do that myself. And it's probably only been available, anything like that, for at most 20, 25 years. It's a one. It's extraordinary wonder of the world. And we get cross if for some reason it's not, the Wi-Fi is not working.
Yeah.
You have to wait a minute. But it's still quicker than the 2 weeks it would have taken. have you lost the sense of wonder of
Oh, I think technology is awful. I think it's terrible.
You think it's terrible?
Yeah, I think in what you described, if I had to say the worst thing isn't waiting 2 weeks. It's the fact that we can't wait a minute.
Yes.
It's turned us into terrible monsters.
Yes. And it stops those things. I don't know if it's more a male thing than a female thing, of little discussions in the pub when somebody said, oh, yeah, he was definitely in such and such a film, or he played for Albion Rovers in the second team. But now... Somebody can just immediately look at, oh, no, he's right and he's wrong.
You can't pick up a woman with just trivia anymore.
No, it's hopeless. So, look, well, thank you very much, Olga, for sharing your wonders, even if they have concentrated rigorously on just everything going on around us here. I have to now pick a wonder of wonders, the wonder that I think you've made the best argument for in all this. It's hard to pick because they're all fairly similar, but I think based on... at any rate, audience reaction. I think rogue child in the audience.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing your wonders with us. Olga Koch.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this episode of My Seven Wonders, it would be wonderful if you could rate and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you found us. Thank you for listening.
My Seven Wonders with Clive Anderson is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying, and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.